Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own.
And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah.
Ken Clark is with us. He's the author of The Story Behind the Mortgage and the Housing Meltdown. He owns First Guarantee Mortgage Corporation and a national leader with business relations and Fannie Mae, Ginny Mae, HUD, and FHA, and the Veterans Administration since 1979. His company underwrites over $1 billion in loans annually, and he's lived through many of the real estate cycles during his professional and during his professional. I don't even know what that word is. Ken, hi, welcome to the show. Now that I've blown the intro, this has got to be good from here on.
That's okay.
I got lost on a word here. I got to get this. During his you got to look at that. You got to look at that bio. It threw me there for a second. But even getting down to it, Ken, so many times. And by the way, welcome to the show. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you very much.
There's so many times that we keep hearing about the housing meltdown, the mortgage problems. Let's go back to the beginning. And let's find out exactly what happened, what caused this to happen in the first place, and done in such a way that the average person listening will understand.
Well, it's really quite simple. As back about 3.5-4 years ago, we went from a period of where, you know, you needed full documentation loans. You need to, you know, have the income, have the what we call ratios, the ability to make the mortgage payment and the rest of your debts. And you had to qualify, and there were strict qualification guidelines that we applied to every borrower. And you also had to have decent credit on your past history of credit. Well, all of a sudden, we started, I guess Wall Street and the rating agencies that buy the big packages of mortgages said, wait a minute, instead of going through all this trouble putting together these thick loan files, let's just look at credit scoring. And if the person has a good credit score, they must be a good credit risk, let them tell us what they make, let them tell us what they have in the bank, and we'll qualify them that way. Well, for about a year and a half, that worked out wonderfully. These mortgages performed as well or better than any fully documented loan you performed in the past. But the difference was that we were having this enormous appreciation of housing. And people are not going to walk away from or not make payments on something that is, you know, their net worth is going up, you know, daily almost. But as prices and money was readily available and prices continued to rise, anybody who had a decent credit score could borrow. And they obviously were borrowing way more than they should have. And it really, I mean, to put it in simple terms, as soon as the appreciation stopped, everything crumbled. People were not going to continue to pay on investment properties or regular homes that were being devalued daily. I mean, just today, this afternoon, watching the news, last month prices declined 4.5% nationally, just in 1 month. Now, this has been going on now for 2.5 years. So we've seen prices in the Florida area go from a $400,000 house maybe selling for $70,000 now. In Washington, D.C., a $500,000 house may only be down to $450,000. So each area in the country is different, but it really is the availability of money to anybody that had a decent credit score, not looking at the whole picture of the borrower, meaning how much he actually made and how much he actually had in the bank to sustain this loan, and everybody was out there borrowing. And now we've created even a bigger problem that's going to come up in the future. We could talk about that later if you want, but that's a I hope, a simple explanation.
Yeah, it is. Let's take it a step farther. Let's talk about the banks themselves. The banks, effectively, they packaged, 5, 10, 15, 20 loans, whatever it was, together, and then they sold those packages. Those packages then were packaged with other packages and got leveraged, and the value for them skyrocketed, and then those obviously got sold again. And then by the time the crash happened, this great big package of multi-billion dollars that people were investing in were maybe only worth a couple of million. And I think that in and of itself caused a tremendous amount of the crash.
Well, that's you're talking about the side of the crash that is more that the average American doesn't know about. That's a
right.
That's the back end part of what caused Wall Street and, Bear Stearns and those big companies to have serious problems. But for the individual that's really facing this today, and just tonight on the news it was talking about it for 15 minutes, is really the devaluation of the housing industry. We haven't seen that, certainly not to this extent. And this is just tragic for so many people who really were good borrowers that did get full doc loans, but now have been caught in the crisis that was created by just the appreciation that has now they're seeing their houses, worth half of what they were. And what we've forgotten in this crisis is even though a lot of these people can still afford these houses, nothing changed for them. They all didn't lose their jobs. Some of them have better jobs. Some of them have gotten raises since they qualified. But the psychological impact is very difficult for people to keep putting out a $1,000 payment each month when their neighbor's only putting out a $350 payment on the same house in the neighborhood that they bought 3 months ago as opposed to 3 years ago. So that's a big problem. But the real problem is not even happening yet. And that's, when you want to get to it, we'll talk about it. But the real problem is credit scoring, and that's something that I'm really concerned about going forward.
And I think what we're also looking at, too, there are people who walked away from their homes, and the reason they walked away from their homes was because you said it early on. Maybe there was a $500,000 home when it was purchased, and that was the average value, the cost of the home. Now, in today's market, that same house is worth $75,000. Now they're sitting on property where there's no projection of the real estate cycle, the boom and the bust and the up and the down. That's not happening right now. And there are people who are paying thousands of dollars a month for something that's not worth it.
And they either have to look at them like many of us are, is this is our home, this is where we live, this is where we're going to raise our kids, and just deal with it. But it's not the investment it was before. And, it's a real tragedy out there.
Well, sure, absolutely it's a tragedy because there's a lot of people who lost their homes, and you said it, they were brought up there, they raised their kids there. And when they walk away, that's part of their life. And I think that a lot of the confusion also with a lot of people when they couldn't afford that mortgage, it was who to pay it to. And when I say who to pay it to, somebody bought something who bought something that bought somebody something, and they didn't have any idea who owned the property. And there were people that were sitting for a year, 2 years without making a payment whatsoever. And it was very confusing for most people.
I know people right now that have not made payments for more than that, and the banks aren't doing anything. They're just so inundated that it's who the next one in line is to go to foreclose on.
Yeah.
So it really is a lot worse than I think was originally thought, and then it kind of slowed down there with the media attention and all. And now it's starting to pick up again because it's really hitting home with a lot of people that what's going on, and we're not seeing it stopping. We get a couple bits of good news in certain pockets of the country, but then you hear that prices dropped another 4%. I mean, we didn't have prices drop 4% in a year before. Now we're seeing them in a month, and it's bad. But there are solutions out there, but the solutions are to be able to people have to be able to qualify for the house, be able to afford the house. And fortunately or unfortunately right now, many people could get by a house that they could afford and pay for at a very decent price. But because of credit scoring, these people who bought before, and you're talking about an unprecedented number of people who are now in, have mortgage problems, now can never, I shouldn't say never, under the current guidelines, can't buy a house. So we don't even have the people to come through the system right now to spark a real estate recovery. It's impossible.
Ken, what happened to all the houses that the banks are holding
out there with enough credit scoring that would qualify them for a mortgage? Because now what they've done is they've raised the credit scoring. They've raised the minimum. In the last 5 years, previous to 2008, every government loan issued, 80% were of every government loan issued was below a 640 credit score, was below. And those loans have performed historically wonderfully, absolutely fine. They're, without FHA, we would, our country would be crippled. The housing industry would be crippled. Now, 80% of every loan that they issue is above 660. Now, they've taken out 80% of the population that used FHA. It was meant for people who didn't have the perfect credit. That's what it was established for. And now it's no different than Fannie or Freddie. You have this, they require these high, they don't really require it. The investors buying these loans require it, these high credit scores. And now you've got this whole population of people that could buy houses at decent prices today that cannot even qualify for an FHA loan. So that's...
Yeah, Ken, let me hold you up because there's got to be something underneath this. And when I say that is that, you know, when the banks ended up with a lot of these homes, I couldn't even give you a number of the amount of real estate that the banks are holding onto, and they're sitting there empty with absolutely no buyers. Now you got people out there on the other side that can't create the credit score to be able to qualify to buy a house in the first place.
Right.
It would seem as though if somebody was smart someplace, they would drop the conditions for someone to buy a house and let some of these houses go. My goodness, even if you had a $500,000 house that's going to sell for $75,000 to $150,000 today, that could be in somebody's affordable price range because, the you know, on a 30-year fixed mortgage, you're talking the same thing as renting, if not cheaper. So there's
actually right now we do performers on people buying, and it's much cheaper to actually buy than it is to rent right now. And what you just said right there very articulately is the biggest frustration that we have as lenders right now and certainly borrowers out there. Now, here's a perfect example. And we're a Fannie Mae, what we call Home Path lender. So I'm not going to put down this program because we do a ton of it. But Home Path is a program that Fannie Mae came out with for selling their real estate that they own, which is millions of homes all over the country, millions. Now, the prices are fair. They're not exaggerating the price. There's a fair market value, so they've seen drops of 70, 80, 90% in some areas of Florida, 50, 60 in other parts of the country. And they will sell these houses to borrowers with zero money down, zero money. Now, you would think people would just line up to buy these houses at these great prices. They even have what they call a Home Path construction program where you can go in and pick a house that's been a little bit torn up from foreclosure or whatever, and fix it up, and borrow that money at 100% of value. So you can build your dream home, put no money down, and get a Fannie Mae home. And right now, 80% of every home sold by Fannie Mae is a cash buyer because they can't get people to qualify.
Yeah.
They don't have the credit scoring. Fannie requires 660 minimum credit score, and they can't find them. So people are buying with cash. But these aren't the people that need the homes. These are the people that are buying them up as investor properties. They stay on the market for 15 days, and then investors can come in and buy them, and they're the ones buying them. The average individual that you just talked about can't buy these because of credit scoring, the requirements. And you know, it's how frustrating because the people that their credit score is such, the computer, the way it calculates it, I see more loans that I would do at a 640 credit score than at a 740 credit score, just by the way the computer calculates credit score. And that's another thing that we've allowed just to inundate our system with this, you know, technology that has nothing to do with the reality whether a person will pay or not pay. we saw more loans go bad at higher credit scores than we have at lower credit scores, but that's a whole other subject for another day. But sure. That's the frustrating part. So from our standpoint as a lender, we're out there qualifying person after person after person, and 1 out of 10 of them can even qualify for a loan. That is probably the best program I have ever seen to buy a property for individuals that have good credit scores. Great pricing, 100% financing, payments that are lower than you could rent an apartment in that area for, and they can't buy it, and they're being sold all cash.
Sure. No, and I got it loud and clear. And there's got to be a fix to this, because in the old days, and I don't know how it works with mortgages, but if you had enough down payment, you could buy anything credit scores.
Exactly.
Didn't yeah, but I don't think that's going to work today regarding houses. You can buy a car.
The real fix today is really simple. If we just went to guideline underwriting, took FHA's guidelines, Fannie Mae guidelines, and just had put the personal touch on it, have an underwriter look at the whole person, how he got himself in trouble, if in fact his credit score shows some trouble, analyze, is that something to reoccur? Is it going to continue to happen? And determine whether he's a good credit risk. Just by doing that and doing prudent underwriting, better than what we're doing now anyway, we would be able to sell probably 50% more homes, and they wouldn't go bad, because we're not going to have the devaluation from this point. At least let's hope not. If we do, then we're in big trouble. But at this point, you've got to believe that we're somewhere near the bottom and that values are there, and this is a good time to buy. If you
believe that, let me hold you up because we're starting to run out of time, not as a credit score,
and determine if he's qualified. That's part of the solution right there.
Okay, we're starting to run out of time, but there's one question I have to ask beforehand, which I think is critical as you were talking. Who is doing the oversight on all of this? What agency is responsible for setting the guidelines here? Because you're talking about a great way to do it, but you've got to have somebody open the door to be able to do this, to put it up on the table. So the real question here is, who's the oversight committee on this entire thing?
Well, unfortunately, what's happened, and I don't really, to be honest with you, as much long as I've been in the business, I can't even answer honestly how all this has come about, because prior to this period, and I mean prior to 2008, when somebody came in to borrow from us under a, let's say FHA, because that really is, believe it or not, is really where people, I mean, it's up to almost $400,000 loans. So that covers a good portion of the loans out there right now. And those people that came in to buy, we simply qualified them whether they met FHA guidelines. And lending was fine. We couldn't turn them down based on arbitrary reasons that we were what we call overlays. Okay, we don't like people that buy in certain parts of a city, or we don't like people that don't have full-time jobs for 5 years. For 2 years. We want them to have it for 5 years. Well, those would be our overlays, not the guideline overlays. So we would approve loans and sell them off, package them up like you talked about, and sell them off. Now, all of a sudden, the people buying the loans, the Wells Fargo's, the Bank of America's, the big servicers of government loans, are putting their own overlays. What they're saying is, if you want to sell us a loan, which all mortgage companies have to sell their loans, they can't portfolio them. If you want to sell us a loan, you have to sell us only loans with this credit score. Well, that credit score is not a guideline under FHA. So they're putting arbitrary guidelines on a program that the guideline doesn't exist, but we have to do it, even though the borrower is qualified. So it would really take a government, and I've tried to get this through. I've met with senators, congressmen, until I'm blue in the face, and trying to get them to come up with some guideline that requires the banks to buy an approvable FHA loan under FHA guidelines. That would happen, that would open up that market. Under Fannie and Freddie, they do set their own guidelines. They can set credit scores. They can do whatever they want. And everybody's under pressure right now because of the debacle that's happened to try to look like they're doing prudent underwriting. So any drop in credit scoring looks like they're trying to lower the quality, which in fact, if they just went to not using automation completely, but putting the personal touch on it, it would give them a better quality. But that's a hard thing for the public or the people in charge to swallow. So under FHA, it would just be simply having the banks buy the guidelines to the products and not putting their own guidelines on them, and Fannie and Freddie would have to come up with their own. But that's really the frustration right now.
Ken, we're out of time, but what I just heard you say is the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, and we're at the effect of it. And with that, a website we can find you at and buy the book.
Yep. It's KennethEClark.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Ken Clark, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. And go get them. Nice job.
Thank you very much.
I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. Someday, I don't know how, I hope the Schiller hear my plea. Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do, till all my dreams true. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do, till all my lover's dreams come true. Because I want a girl to call my own. I wanna dream, I don't have to dream alone. Please don't make me dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Opportunities grow businesses, and knowing which ones to capitalize on is what drives business success. And in this milestone book, our author has integrated three fundamental principles of good business: leverage, process, and entrepreneurial thinking into a pragmatic and powerful approach to business development. The book is the 90% rule. It's a practical step-by-step plan that shows you how to turn your opportunities into actual action. And our guest co-host, Ken Tenser. Ken, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, it's true in today's mass market of everybody's out there for the customer, there's got to be something a little bit different that will allow a business to drive itself to success. The 90% rule, what is it, and when did you discover it?
Well, the 90% rule, it's a mindset that I've always used in building businesses. I mean, it's about understanding what you're 90% capable of, and then always be asking yourself what that next 10% is that you can do. You know, the next product, service, or process that you can bring out to further ingratiate your customers. And I came about it as a young entrepreneur when, you know, I like most entrepreneurs, I didn't have big budgets. I didn't have a lot of capital available. So I had to figure out what my logical next step for growth was and what I was, as I used to say, 90% capable of achieving. And it really helped me grow from market to market and grow within myself as a company, within my resources, my financial capital and manpower, and at that time inventory and whatnot, and it really seemed to be very intuitive and logical, and helped me grow my business in a more safe and but still very dynamic way.
You know, most businesses have they've got a foundation that they work with, and I think the biggest problem is they need somebody looking over their shoulder every once in a while to bring quote unquote the invisible up to the table, because it's things that they don't see. And the three facets that I was talking about, which is on the back of your book, you know, leveraging the entrepreneurial thinking, et cetera. And it's very critical that people begin to look at their businesses different today if they're going to be successful in that insane marketplace we have out there.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the key to success really is to deeply understand your business and what your customer wants, and You know, I look at, you know, very successful people who are very focused. I mean, you think of Oprah, and she's never defined herself as a talk show host. She talks about self-improvement and self-empowerment. And that focus has actually given her that incredible ability to move from, you know, being a talk show host to moving into, you know, reviewing books and putting out movies and now the network. But all to do, again, with self-improvement or self-empowerment. And I think that you also have to step back and really understand what your core business is really about. And you'll find that if you really focus, that focus won't limit you. It's going to open up so many doors and so many growth opportunities.
And Ken, when there's a book, but there's also, you've got the half-day workshops that you do. When do you do those? Where do you do those? And somebody coming to that workshop, what are they going to walk away with?
Well, we do that with specifically with individual companies, or sometimes we do that with management groups. And it really just starts to open their eyes to, one, how important innovation is today, the fact that, you know, you've got to keep ingratiating your customers with new and thoughtful ideas and products and services to keep up that relationship. Two, we show them that innovation is an invention. It's just not as hard as a lot of people think it is. And one very quick example, I mean, you look at the grocery market. I mean, they cut up fruit and they put it in plastic containers and set up a whole takeout section. And that was very innovative and, to me, very brilliant, because it focused on customer needs and time saving, and it got them moving forward. So, you know, after we understand innovation and what it's about and how to break through some of the barriers, we go into identifying opportunities, how to identify, how to filter opportunities, which to me is probably the most important thing in business, so that you're choosing the right ones. And finally, open people's eyes and, you know, to how to implement them, because innovation really is. It's about translating ideas into action. It's about bringing great new things to market. And you can't walk out that door and let that bright light disappear. You got to have an action plan. And that's what we really try and hammer home with the people that we work with.
Ken, one of the things that I've noticed, I've done consulting on and off for years, and I remember that early on years ago, I'd walk into a business and I would sit down with the CEO, the COO, whatever the case may be, and have them write down what they thought that their subordinates' jobs were, whatever managers there were. And they would write that down, then it would go over to the manager, and I would say, okay, write down what you think your job is and what you think that they think from in the head office, what they think that you should be doing. And 9 out of 10 times, Ken, it was never the same thing. What they thought their job was not what the CEOs thought the job was, and it trickled all the way down through the business. And the key was that they weren't focused. They thought they were focused, but they weren't focused, and everybody was running in a different direction. Once they got into the same direction, things started to happen, and bottom line started to increase.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's bang on, and it's one of the reasons, too, that in our process we start, one, by assembling teams that just aren't C-suite. They are the managers from production or HR, R&D, whatever's relevant. And we make sure that everybody in the senior management, the C-suite, and then the next level down, understand what the business is about, understand where the business wants to go, and have everybody articulate that together, because, as you say, it's amazing how same company and everybody has a different idea about where it should be going or where it could be going. So day one, we want people to get on the same page, and once they do, it becomes that much easier to figure out, you know, opportunities and how to bring them to market.
Now, by the way, growth, and a very interesting word, there's a way to grow, isn't there? You know, so many people jam into it, we're going to grow, and they cut prices, they do this, they do that, and it's all this customer-oriented, I'm going to call it nonsense, that they go through, and 6 months to a year later, they're out of business. Growth in and of itself is a whole definition and a process, isn't it?
Well, it is, and that's why I said, too, before, I think the most important part of our process is the filtering part. And it's amazing because, you know, there's so many opportunities that come to us, and the most common thing, I guess, I hear is I don't know which one to choose. I don't know how to grow. So we look at, you know, three different metrics, if you will, your global objectives like vision and mission, your sales and marketing, and then your financial, understanding your key ratios. So when you have an opportunity that comes to you, we help you develop this dashboard, if you will, so that you can rank and rate the different opportunities against all these key criteria. Because you're right, you know, there's just too many stories in the news today about CEOs announcing that they're selling non-core assets or that businesses are closing down. And yeah, I completely agree. I just don't think that people have that rigor and that understanding of what they should choose to do and why it's good for their business. So filtering, very key to what we do.
And let's talk about dollars for the moment, funding in and of itself. Too many businesses go into businesses without the right funding, and they find themselves strapped. They find themselves at that point where it could be successful, but they don't have the money to be able to move forward. What do you do with that? When somebody is in a business, how do you determine that for someone?
Well, I guess there's two answers to that. The first one is that sounds like the story of my entrepreneurial life and most entrepreneurs I know. And I think that that's why I've always looked for opportunities I'm 90% capable of, because like most entrepreneurs, I started with a proverbial bucket and paddle and credit card that I'd rub for good luck at, you know, when I started out in my 20s. But it's amazing, you know, that old saying, diamonds are created under pressure. If you understand where you're going and what you need to do, it's amazing how you can break that down into steps and stay focused and get there with intellectual capital versus financial capital. On the other side, there definitely is a time where you need a certain amount of money. And I think that people going into their businesses, I mean, I always tell them to take their projections and lower sales sometimes by half and sometimes double their expenses and figure out what it would be to live with little to no income for a while. And if that doesn't work on paper, it's not going to work on real life. So you will have to look for some angel investments or other sources of funds.
Now, there's a statement here. Develop a dashboard to filter the best opportunities for your organization. In business, what's a dashboard?
A dashboard, I mean, it's really like looking at the dashboard on your car. It's sort of that instrumentation. And ours is, let's say the left-hand column is a list of opportunities. And across the top go the different criteria to rate those opportunities. Again, your vision, your mission, on a scale of 1 to 10, is the opportunity, is it in keeping with the vision for your company, with your sales and marketing objectives, such as you want to go for into new markets or build existing ones, and financial criteria, things like I ask people, what are the most important or the single most important thing to identify on your balance sheet or on your income statement or the certain ratio? So you get that grid, opportunities on the left, criteria across the top, and then you've got your numbering system of 0 to 10, and you just simply add it up, divide it, and let's see which great opportunities float to the top.
Now, most businesses, well, I won't say most businesses, there are successful businesses that usually have a marketing plan, a business plan. And what I have noticed, those that implement them and they forecast out, in 6 months we should be making this, in a year we should be making that. They get to the six-month period or the quarter, and they're either on target, they're making more, or they're not making enough. That's when they have to go into action, implement quote-unquote plan B to get them back on track. How critical is that in the start of a business, or better yet, implementing into an existing business to just make sure they're more successful? Is that critical?
Oh, I think it's critical. I mean, if you don't have a goal, if you don't have an end goal, then you certainly can't get there, as they say. So you really need to know where you want to be in 6, 12, 18 months. But I think more importantly is that if you move this whole innovation thinking and this whole ideation into a daily mode rather than a once-a-year mode, you have a much better opportunity to get to where you want to be. I mean, as I always say, I mean, you wouldn't change the oil in your car once a year because it's going to sputter and die. And too many people, you know, they leave ideation or innovative thinking to once-a-year retreats. Well, you know what? Your business engine is going to sputter and die too, because great companies aren't coming up with ideas once a year, once or every 2 years anymore. So, sure, have your objectives, have your goals. You need to know where you want to be, but don't think about ways to get there once every year or two. Think about them daily. Think about them monthly, and I just think you'll have that much more opportunity to succeed.
And there's the creation of that I'm going to call it the brain power from the business in and of itself, because I think what happens with most people, they're aware of the business, but they're running the business the way the culture was 6 months, a year ago, 2 years ago, and there's not somebody in there watching what happens to the customer trends. Customers have a definition, and that definition changes. The marketplace changes based on what the not only what the economy is at the time, but how that consumer buys. We live in a world now that the consumer, you get a different consumer here. It's a consumer that wasn't around 10, 12, 13 years ago. You got an e-consumer now. You got somebody who can press a button, find out anything they want about anything, and get whatever they want at the price that they want. So if you're out selling something, that's what you're up against. And if you know it, you can combat it. If you don't, you're in trouble.
Well, I agree with that, but as you said, you know, anybody can go online and through e-commerce purchase what they want, get what they want, and research and buy in a new way. But so too can companies. I mean, through social media, by watching what people buy, by getting instant feedback as to what the trends are in the marketplace, and by using social media and getting feedback as to what people are thinking, what they believe in today. So, you know, this whole notion of the e-world works both ways. If they're buying that much more quickly online and the trends are changing that much more quickly, yeah, but you've got the opportunity to study them, and definitely you have to stay on top of them. But the opportunity definitely goes both ways.
No question about it. Ken, I picked the book up, The 90% Rule, What's Your Next Big Opportunity, and I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, the business person, get out of this book?
Well, I think that the key message here is that innovation drives marketing, drives sales. The essence of innovation is coming up with new ideas to continuously delight your customer. And if they're going online and buying in new and different ways, you've got to keep up. And the way to keep up is to come up with new products and services, and that's innovation. So, you know, learn innovation, learn how it drives your marketing, learn how that leads to increased sales, and you're going to have a good, healthy, ongoing business.
Wonderful. Ken, we're just about out of time. A website we can find you at?
The90percentrule.com, and that's 90, the number, percentrule.com spelt out.
Wonderful. Hey, Ken, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I appreciate the time, and we can get the book there. Also, on your website, can we find out about the seminars and the workshops you do?
Oh, absolutely. The keynotes, seminars, workshops, it's all there, and the book is available through the website or Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, so very easy to find.
Ken Tenser, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Good night.
For you and you alone, oh, that's all, oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. That's all, that's all. Give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Stop that. Here.
Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true. And a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark, something like that. Kathy Puckett was with us, Dr. Kathleen Puckett. She is the co-author of Homeland Insecurity, former FBI psychological profiler in the counterterrorism unit. Kathy, hey, welcome back.
Hi, Michael. You know, the reason I think you said Dresser After Bark is because my dog was acting up just as you were coming on.
I knew it.
He was barking.
There's a connection with the dog. I know it's there. We're going to talk about Norway for a moment. And
yeah.
That I heard this morning, which is very interesting. The rule of law there, the way the Norwegians look at putting someone in jail, maximum sentence you can get is 21 years, no matter what you do. This guy killed, 90-some-odd people.
Right,
the worst
right.
you can do is 21 years because they believe somebody will go in there and they'll fix themselves. Now, the other thing is when they get out in 21 years, they can get retrialed for another 5 years and retrial for another 5 years, but that's that. But when you get something like this, something as heinous and horrendous as this, a 21-year law does not seem to be the best answer for this.
No, I know a lot of people in America are appalled by that. However, let me just say that 21-year sentence is the maximum for someone who's found competent and someone for whom mental illness is not an issue. For example, John Hinckley is still in prison because he was determined to be mentally ill. And he is still technically, you know, behind bars because of that, not because the statute of limitations for the shooting, the attempted murder of the president, President Reagan, in 1981 is long past, but he is still in prison because of the mental health issue. And that looks to be, I wouldn't assume as a result, Michael, that the Norwegian criminal justice system will be stymied by 21 years. There's going to be a lot more to consider for them.
Yeah, they're going to have to take a look at this, him, and their entire justice system. And as far as the question whether he's mentally unbalanced or mentally unhealthy, I don't think there's a question there. You don't have to take a test. Look what the guy did.
Well, you know, that's interesting. Now you've just said something very interesting. You've said that, look at what the guy did. How could someone who did what he did not be crazy?
Yeah.
That is a huge question in jurisprudence, Michael, because the whole reason for forensic psychology and the intersection of psychology and the law, you know, especially the courts, is when exactly is someone culpable and when are they not? In our system of justice, someone who does not understand the difference between right and wrong, which this guy certainly does understand. He says he knew he did something horrendous. But there are other measures of sanity that he's probably not going to do as well on. In the same way, Michael, this is exactly the same thing that Theodore Kaczynski, the Unabomber, our case that we wrote about in Hunting the American Terrorist, our first book, this was exactly the situation that the prosecution was faced with. What do we do, in his case, of course, he didn't have the number of victims, but he had 16 years of mayhem and terrorism.
Sure.
So the question was for the court to determine, is this guy, first of all, is he sane or insane? There are different degrees of that. That has to be determined by psychiatrists and psychologists, and testing and examination.
Yeah, let me jump just for a second.
You can also, let me just say, though, you can also be insane and still be culpable. Insane, guilty but insane. Or you can be not guilty by reason of insanity.
Okay,
there's lots of different, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, if I'm a sociopath and I just don't care, and if I could kill you and sit down and have dinner while you're laying there bleeding, am I crazy?
Well, that's now you've hit on something else interesting. You're putting your finger on all the critical questions of forensic psychology and psychiatry. Basically, we are not really sure in psychology whether psychopathy or sociopathy is a psychopath or sociopath is mental illness or a condition of being more akin to a personality disorder, which is a way of being. It's kind of like a friend of mine used to describe it, that it's like when you bake a cake and you leave something out. That cake is baked. The psychopath is made. He or she is lacking the ability to empathize with other human beings. Therefore, he doesn't care. Is that mental illness, or is it a condition, a specific condition, a way of being in a personality? Because these people will pass all kinds of other tests regarding reality testing. They're not, their sense of what is real and what is not real is intact. They know who they are. They know who other people are. They just don't care. That is a real question in psychology as to whether that is an illness or a way of being that is still not understood in the human psyche.
No, by the way, when I got that loud and clear, but when you've got someone like this, someone who literally kills, 90-some-odd people, who intentional, this is intentional, this was no accident, this obviously had to be planned. But there was an ideology that drove him. And that
that's exactly what we're talking about. Okay, that's now you're hitting on exactly what Terry and I found in our investigations when we were working in the 90s, in the mid to late 90s, and early 2000, 2001, regarding lone wolf terrorists. You know, what makes these people like Timothy McVeigh? Timothy McVeigh wanted to do much the same as Breivik did. He wanted to start a new American revolution. This guy wanted to start a revolution against Muslims in his own country.
Yeah.
Theodore Kaczynski wanted to start a revolt against technology. These people are motivated by ideology because they don't have... I guarantee you, when I first heard about this case, I got called immediately on this case because, of course, with the Unabomber in our background and our history, and Terry was on Fox News with Shepard Smith, and everyone is always bewildered by these cases when they come forward. But we studied this extensively, and I did a study for the FBI counterterrorism division about who are these people and why do they do this? Why is it that they're not members of groups? And what we found was it's not because they don't want to be members of the groups. They all wanted to be members of a group that had their particular ideology. They all wanted to be that. They tried repeatedly to be part of a group, but they were socially unable to. They were social misfits. All of them were. Timothy McVeigh, as he grew into adulthood, became a social misfit. Theodore Kaczynski was always what he referred to as a social cripple. Eric Rudolph didn't care about anybody. He wanted to present himself as a group, but had no close relationships with anyone, was even out of touch with his family for months or years at a time. So these people operate on what they want to do, since they can't make connections with other people. And it's not that they don't want to, it's just that they can't. What they do is they connect to the ideology, the radical ideology, and it makes them the true believers, and it makes them lash out in huge ways, like Breivik shooting, nearly 100 teenagers and killing other people with the bomb that he had parked at the building in Oslo. It's the level of their violence is huge because they need to matter. they've never been able to matter in society, and they need to matter. And I guarantee you, this guy's supposed, I will almost go on record here. I'll go on record here with you, Michael, as saying, I would bet anything, I will bet any part of my vast estate, that this guy had no active membership in any radical group or specific group. He was a fringe member because he wasn't able to be part of any team. He's a singleton, like they all are, these lone wolf terrorists.
The big problem is, and it's a big problem for a lot of people too, on a much minor level. You don't get acceptance. You said that in a little different way. But the one thing that the guy was lacking, obviously, and there's a lot of people lack the same thing today, is purpose. You get into
right.
a group.
Right.
Group usually bands together because they're moving in a single direction. No, no purpose. And if you don't have that purpose, you're going to start searching. And if you can't find it externally, sometimes you find it internally. And there
exactly.
Yeah, and there's a filter between your conscious and your unconscious mind. When that gets overloaded, that filter breaks down, things pour into the unconscious, and the unconscious doesn't deal in facts. It doesn't have a language like we're talking now. It deals in pictures and symbols. And when something gets into that unconscious mind, it takes it on as a goal to achieve. It takes it on as a reality. And when he's created his own purpose inside that mind, then, yeah, effectively, that's what caused him to do what he did, and he did it, and I'm sure he felt he was right about doing it. It gave him purpose, it gave him identity, and it gave him a legacy which he would have never had.
Now, here's exactly, that's the whole point, a legacy he never would have had because he didn't have a significant relationship with enough people to matter. They want to matter. If you're part of a group, you mean something to somebody else. You mean something to the group. You're part of the group. If you're not, if you're by yourself, human beings are social animals.
Sure.
We are wired that way. And these people, the wiring in these lone wolf terrorists is off to the extent where they do not get the connection, they cannot make the connection that they desperately always want with these radical group members. So they've got to matter another way. And now the challenge is to show. This is what the big mystery is. This is what the courts take over. Now he's in custody. You'll notice, just like all the rest of these lone wolf terrorists, he surrendered. He did not kill himself. He was not suicidal. He wanted to get his message out.
Yeah. And by the way,
like this.
And by the way, it did not have to be the Muslims. It was that, you know, he was looking for a target. And that target happened.
No, it did happen. He was centered on the, and it was not only Muslims, it was the immigration, and Europe is having increasing, incidents of anti-immigration sentiment throughout. I mean, in Germany, I know even the prime minister said that, she said that multiculturalism has failed.
Yeah. No, I got it loud and clear.
In Europe.
But he needed a target.
Right.
And the target
but
was the pot.
He fully believes, Michael, fully believes that he is justified because he truly does believe that Muslims are have the, as just as a Knights Templar believed in during the Crusades, that the Muslims wanted to destroy all Christians. Therefore, it's a holy war for him.
Kathy, who did he kill?
Well, in his mind, it was linked to the Muslim threat. He wanted to get attention for. The problem is that his target was the government, his first, the car bomb, the government, and then what he did was horrify the public. That's what terrorism is.
Sure.
It's the use of terror to change a society. As far as targeting, his killing children is about the worst kind of thing that anybody can think of as far as anybody for a society. So if you don't listen to me, I'm going to kill your children.
Yeah.
This is serious. I'm going to kill your children. Well, they can't ignore him when he does that. That's his whole point.
Yeah. No, and I got that also loud and clear. So his target was something that caused everybody to take notice. His
right.
purpose was
horrified everybody, terrified everybody.
Yeah. Oh, it would have terrified me, too. I'm sure it would have, just to see children laying there dead. I mean, that's
going to the world is horrified by this. The world is horrified. You know, in his mind, he may have thought, What will horrify people more, if I shoot people at a mosque or if I shoot innocent children? Well, it's going to horrify people more if I shoot innocent children. It will get everybody's attention. And look at what's happened.
Yeah, no question.
Yeah, he's done what he wanted to do. He's gotten attention to his cause by an act of domestic terrorism on a huge scale that has impacted the rest of the world, and everybody's horrified. Michael, you and I both know that if he had attacked a mosque, it would have been a big story, but it wouldn't have been the story it is.
That's true. No, it is. It's very true. I mean, no question about that. And I think this is going to bring something else up, and this is going to be another show, obviously. But I want to talk about what's going on, and let's look at this next week. I want to talk about what's going on with the law. Is our court system what our court system is supposed to be? The end result of a lot of these things that are going on in the court systems, I have to sometimes sit back and take a look because I can't quite get what the judges are doing and what they're thinking in the way they do things. So I want to really take a look at it. Is the law truly the law today? And is it gone beyond the rule of law to the whim and the desire of the judge?
I think that is a really good question to talk about next week.
Yeah, I think it's extremely important. Okay, can we get a website where we can find you at?
Sure. Our website for the blog is homelandinsecuritytheblog.com, Michael.
And by the way, thanks for that shot last week about now I can't wear the tinfoil when I think the rays are coming in, because now you've let me know that it amplifies.
That's right.
Don't worry about it.
All will be well.
Oh, thank you. Okay, I'm going to sit here and wait until next week. Okay, good night.
Okay. Thanks, Kathy. Good night, Michael.
Bye-bye.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. David Vando with us. He is the author of Shakespeare for the 21st Century. That's the second edition. He's the owner director of Models Mart Limited, a resource center based in New York City for the modeling and acting professionals worldwide. He's also the author of Shakespeare for the 21st Century, a paperback book about how quotes from the bard can and should be used in the new millennium for everything from corporate mottos to epitaphs. And let us say, David, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Ray. Michael Ray, it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you. David, let me ask you this. Shakespeare in and of himself, what was it about Shakespeare that kept us, and everybody, from a 10-year-old to an adult today, still, if you say Shakespeare, they know who you're talking about. What was it about this man that left such an impact historically?
Well, it's hard to just point at one facet of the man. He's just too complex and too fascinating an individual. Without a doubt, one of the greatest minds of all time. I can only speak for myself. I fell in love with Shakespeare when I was a child. I was invited to, when I was 12 years old, to see a performance, a matinee performance here in New York, of Twelfth Night. I had never seen Shakespearean play before, but I knew who Shakespeare was. And I went to that matinee, and I sat down, and it began. It began with a musical prologue, and I love that because I love music.
Yeah.
And then as I sat back and I listened to the plot unfold, I started realizing that I recognized a number of the phrases and sayings that were being used in the script. And I just fell in love with Shakespeare and fell in love with the theater, and I've never looked back.
David, to tie it into today, you know, when we look at the world today as it is, the problems that we have in this, and if you were to tie some of the quotes that Shakespeare said into today's world, what should we listen to that could make a difference or a change in the way we view and we look at life?
Well, two things. Shakespeare was just not a great thinker. He was also a great entertainer. And he had a wonderful sense of comedy and words. But even in his comedies, there is a fundamental moral being taught, which is just as valid today as it was in his time. In Shakespeare's world, love is the most important theme. Whenever we humans lose our sense of humanity and our sense of love with one another, tragedy inevitably results. So, in the case of Romeo and Juliet, for example, the two warring families, feuding families, keep the lovers apart, and what happens? Tragedy. Iago puts a barrier between the love of Desdemona and Othello, and what happens? Tragedy. Again and again and again, Shakespeare shows us what happens when we lose that sense of love. And I think that's one of our greatest problems today, in today's world.
Well, and obviously there's a lot of merit to what you just said, but then we have to define what love means from country to country to culture to culture to culture. You know, love is many, many things to many people, and I think what the problem is we don't look beyond the surface to go deep within to see that connection that everybody has, and we all have the same connection. I don't care where we're from. But it gets masked, it gets hidden. And every once in a while, I believe if you sat down and you watched a Shakespearean play or something, or heard the right music with the right vibration, all of a sudden those things that you mask yourself with, you hide, the facades that you use, melt away for that moment. But if we could take that moment, move it through our lives, all of a sudden the world would be different.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be wonderful if there could be productions of Romeo and Juliet done for the Palestinians and Israelis and North Korea and South Korea, so that, you know, it's a tragedy what happens to the young lovers. But finally, the result of the tragedy is cathartic, because the warring families stop killing each other and make peace.
Yeah. And effectively, that would be a wonderful thing that if it could happen today. But when we take Shakespeare, how do you introduce, I'm going to call it the Shakespearean, let's call it an ideology, into the schools whereby they can understand it, they can live with something like that. Because really, if you want to touch somebody, for the most part, the adults, it's not going to hit them, because there's so many things that go on in a day. They're living 10 minutes ahead, 20 minutes behind, and never focusing on now and always what it's going to be and what it used to be, and today just doesn't work out. But if you start it out young, if you start them young and you get that vibration going when they're young, then they bring it into the world around them as they grow into it, because the young ones today are going to be the very people who are going to be running this planet in 15, 20, 25 years.
Well, as has been said by the Jesuits, give me the first 7 years of a child's life and you can have the rest. And I believe that if you introduce Shakespeare to young people, just as young people would have gone to see performances in Elizabethan times. You don't allow them to get into the situation a little later in life where Shakespeare becomes like a burden to them, the way it's sometimes taught in schools. Shakespeare was never really meant to be taught or read. It was meant to be performed and enjoyed. So when young people can pick up Shakespeare, whether it's his sonnets to begin with, perhaps, or other parts of his plays and do scenes and things, and find the joy and humor and the understanding of it, well, then they're hooked for life, just as I was. But we seem to create artificial barriers. We have people say, oh, I can't understand Shakespeare. It doesn't make any sense to me, Old English, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, in point of fact, Shakespeare is part of our everyday language in so many ways. So many of his expressions are everyday expressions. Nothing succeeds like success. Love is blind. The course of true love never did run smooth. One fell swoop. For goodness sakes, words pay no debts. Those are all common phrases that are a part of our everyday language. When people say, well, I can't quote Shakespeare, I can't understand him. In point of fact, they're using Shakespeare on an everyday basis.
Now, by the way, when we say that we're using it, I think that's really what I'm talking about, is the ability, if you're going to teach it, is to recognize it. And I think that's where it is. You know, the brilliance of him in the beginning was acknowledged based on the time and place. But then we get into today. And in today's world, it's not recognized. Maybe the very same things that we do, we look for, we long for, that are buried within the message because it's not said in a way that the audience today would understand it.
That's a possibility. They may not understand it all. There are some things. I've been studying Shakespeare all my life, and there are still things I look up and still find possible different meanings. But that's being very specific. The in the broader sense of the word and the text, Shakespeare's plays play very, very well, and the message is just as clear today as it was then. But it does take, you know, someone to make the effort, someone to decide that they'll go and see a play, that they'll read a sonnet, they'll read some of his material. And point of fact, it's like anything else. You start becoming used to his syntax and his vocabulary, and the more you read it, the more you see it, the more familiar it becomes to you. And so it's more and more accessible to you. And that's one of the aims of my book. Although I treat Shakespeare's quotes in rather ironic ways in my book, for the sense of humor and enjoyment, you're still going over close to 700 quotes from Shakespeare, which I use in a variety of different ways to encourage people to become familiar with Shakespeare in a very accessible way. In the first section of the book, I take quotes and I say, if Shakespeare were alive today, who would he have say some of his famous quotes, you know, such as, can one desire too much of a good thing? Donald Trump. Speak the speech, I pray you, as I pronounced it to you. Arnold Schwarzenegger's acting coach.
Yeah.
I would the gods had nothing else to do but to confirm my curses. Sarah Palin. So much for my praising myself, who I myself will bear witness is praiseworthy. Sylvester Stallone. My bosom is full of kindness. Dolly Parton. So there I'm making ironic use of his quotes and today's characters of life. And in this way, it's a fun way to be introduce or reintroduce to his quotes and see them in a different ironic vein.
Now, by the way, David, are there movies today, anything that's out, that when you sit down and you watch a movie, that you recognize the base of the movie, the guts of the movie, underneath it, that foundation is driven by his feeling, his thoughts, the way he would put himself out to the world?
Yes. There have been a number of contemporary films that have, used Shakespeare plots as a basis for the movies. And Shakespeare did the same thing in his time. He took his plots from other people and rewrote them. For example, The Merchant of Venice was a rewrite of Christopher Marlowe's play, The Jew of Malta. Hamlet was a play before Shakespeare wrote Hamlet. And Taming of the Shrew was also a play that he rewrote. It was only later in his career that when Shakespeare's plays went into the romances and became more abstract, that we really don't have these concrete uses of other people's plays or history for the basis of his dramas.
By the way, David, there was a thought that just came up. Do you think that if we're going the way we're going, that we will lose him eventually? Because there's a certain time when the mindsets are so different that they block themselves to particular ideas, thoughts, etc. Do you think that we will lose him as time goes by?
Of course, anything is possible, and I think that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, was to keep him in the forefront of our minds and put his quotes and things in the perspective of today. But in point of fact, the man's thoughts and ideas are with us today, just as they were over 400 years ago, and he continues to influence artistic works, whether it's ballets, operas, symphonies, musicals. There's really no end to his influence, and it hasn't stopped. It just, as you say, is refashioned for the times. I mean, West Side Story, of course, is a classic example. American musical theater being based on the story of Romeo and Juliet, updated to contemporary times. And just one of the many very successful uses of Shakespeare's work.
Well, now, by the way, what about your own? What are you doing? What are you involved in today yourself?
Well, I wear several hats. I'm an owner of a corporation called Models Mart, as you mentioned, that is a supply house for the modeling talent industry throughout the world. I'm a writer. I write plays and musical theater, and I've done scenarios for ballets. And recently, the last 10 years, I've also been a teacher at the New York Film Academy, where I teach Shakespeare for the contemporary actor, and that has become one of the loves of my life. And it's sort of the teaching of the classes and coming out with the second edition so that I could give this book to my students. It has become a very important last phase, you know, the seven ages of man. I'm sort of heading towards that seventh age, and to me, this has enriched my life. Shakespeare has, of course, influenced me as a writer. I adapted Shakespeare's comedy, Love's Labour's Lost, for a musical theater piece that I did many years ago at the Folger Library Theater in Washington, D.C. So throughout my life, Shakespeare has, you know, really affected my soul.
David, I hear you. We're just about out of time. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yeah, the website is models-mart.com, where the book is for sale. There you can get autographed copies, or for the more up-to-date ones, it's available through Amazon on Kindle. And it's inexpensive, and of course, having it on Kindle only helps you to understand the quotes and the references that I make even more. Those would be the best ways. Also, Facebook. I'm on Facebook, and I have a profile page about the second edition of Shakespeare for the 21st Century. So it's out there. It's readily available. And I'm hoping more and more people will give themselves the opportunity to read it.
Got it. David, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, I want to thank you for asking me. You're asking me is just another way of keeping Shakespeare in front of the minds of the world.
Absolutely. David, good night, and thank you again.
Good night. Thank you very much.
If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.